So let's start with our motivation. Again, appreciating our present circumstance, that we have a body and mind that are healthy and that can understand the Dharma, and we also have the interest in the Dharma. And then, of course, we have the resources to be able to learn it and practice it. So at any of those stages, you know, it's possible to have hindrances. But at this very time, we don't have those hindrances. And we don't know how long this possibility is going to last. And once this life has disintegrated, it is gone. Yeah, the person of this life no longer exists. There's only the continuity of this person. But that continuity might be born in a very different realm, with very different kind of mental capacities, and so on. So it's important to use our opportunity now. Not waste it by being so reactive to the external world around us. Because that reactivity, I like this, I don't like that, want this, I don't want that, that consumes so much time and energy that then we have very little time to think about the Dharma. Or even if we sit down to contemplate or to study, there's lots of interfering thoughts of I want this, I don't want that, I like this, I don't like that. And then those thoughts also generate, they lead to attachment, aversion, all sorts of mental afflictions. And then we wind up creating not the constructive karma that we want to create with this life, but instead a lot of destructive karma. So it's very important to have an attitude of, you know, these are sensory perceptions, you know, these are sense objects, impermanent sense objects that are unsatisfactory by nature. So I don't need to get so wigged out about them and so reactive to them, because their nature is to be transient and change, and their nature is to be unsatisfactory. So no matter what I do, they're not going to be perfect. So in that way, you know, develop some fortitude and be able to set our priorities correctly. And one of the priorities we want to set is the happiness of all living beings in the long term. So not just their happiness in having the things that they need of this life, but their mental happiness that comes from freeing the mind from afflictions. And so caring about that for sentient beings and wanting to benefit them so that they can have that. And knowing the only way to do it is to purify our own mind and gain that capability ourselves. And so therefore we aspire for full awakening, so that we can use the state of awakening to benefit others. And so we're here to learn the Dharma tonight. So this motivation to attain awakening is quite important. But we have to really understand why we want to attain full awakening. We had somebody at the Abbey this last week who had enlightenment fever, as I call it, who wanted to get enlightened ASAP. through opening his pineal gland or doing, I don't know, some kind of something. And, you know, very restless about the present moment because the mind was focused on, I want to be enlightened. And I didn't get the chance to, but I wanted to ask, what are you going to do the day after you get enlightened? Yeah, because often, you know, our mind is fixed on, I want this, but then what are we going to do the day after we get that? Yeah, and so, you know, I wanted to ask, well, what are you going to do the day after you're getting enlightened? You know, whatever his definition of enlightened was. And, you know, we have to be able to say something. What are we going to say? Just sit there and be blissed out? Well, that's nice, but what about everybody else? Yeah. So, you know, we want to attain awakening, not just, okay, we just get to enlightenment, and now I can relax, you know, got that done. Cross that off my list. Yeah. But, you know, what am I going to do the day after what I've been doing the whole time before, which was be focused on the welfare of other living beings? Yeah. And so to, you know, have that firmly planted in our mind so that, you know, we know why we want to follow a spiritual path. Because it's not just about feeling good ourselves. Although we are selfish, and so sometimes that self-centered thought gets us going on the path just because we're miserable right now, so we're looking for something that's better than right now. So that gets us going on the path. But then at a certain point, we have to go beyond that wish for just my own happiness, and especially my own worldly happiness. Yeah, because worldly happiness we're never going to get in a satisfactory way. It's always going to go away. Yeah, because it arises due to causes and conditions, and those causes and conditions are under the influence of ignorance. Yeah, so no matter how famous you are, how much sex you have, what a nice house you have, or boat you have, or, you know, whatever it is that you're wanting, it's all going to go away at some time. Yeah? So to really aspire for, another word for nirvana is the unconditioned, something that's not conditioned by ignorance. That's not going to change and be something else. Okay? And so to want that, not only for ourselves, but for everybody. And so, as a way of creating the cause, we have to understand the Dharma. And so we have been studying Aryadeva's 400 stanzas, and we are now on chapter 10. Which is individual refutation of truly existent functional phenomena. Okay, so refuting a self, yeah. And in particular, what we're going to be getting into in this chapter is refuting a truly existent self or a substantially existent self or just a plain old permanent self. Yeah, because a lot of the schools that existed, you know, in ancient India asserted a permanent self in much the same way as many people nowadays assert a permanent self. You know, there's some kind of soul or self that doesn't change. The definition of permanent is it doesn't change from moment to moment. Okay, so last week we started on the verses. You know, there's this one school, the Vaisheshika, who talk about an inner self and an outer self, and your outer self is your body, the inner self is the person who does things, and then, you know, saying that, you know, what is male, what is female? Is it your outer self? Is it your inner self? You know, and just even in, you know, our own way, coming to realize that although, you know, we have a very strong identity according to the sex we were born as, that whole label comes about simply because of the arrangement of molecules in our body, that there's nothing about our mind that is male or female. Although, for example, hormones in our body may affect our mind, but our mind can also affect our hormones. And then a lot of what we blame on hormones or credit to hormones may actually be things that we've learned that aren't due so much to hormones, but we think, oh, a man is supposed to be like this, a woman's supposed to be like this. Yeah. You getting what I'm saying? Yeah. So we think that, so then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Okay, so we were on verse 27, yeah, which reads, when all the elements are not male, female, or neuter. Neuter means somebody who's neither distinctly male or distinctly female. There's a lot of different variants under that can exist under neuter. So when all the elements are not male, female, or neuter, how is it, how is that which depends on them male, female, or neuter? Okay, so the Vaisheshikas were saying, okay, your body is male, female, or neuter. I might just say male, female for brevity. If you're saying that your body is male or female, then, I mean, exactly what is it in your body that's male or female? Yeah. And does that make your inner self male or female? Because they talked about this inner self. Okay. So they say through the connection of the outer body, the inner self becomes male or female. And so then, Aryadeva replies, well, if that's the case, then the four great elements, you know, earth, water, fire, air, or in our view, we could say all the, you know, elements of the chemical, chemistry table, okay, then they would also have to be male or female. Yeah? Because they're the things that make up our body. So is the carbon in our body male or female? What about the water in our body? Male, female, neuter. What is it? Okay. So if you're going to say that there's an outer self that influence that's male or female, then the elements that would have to be the person, because a male and a female are people. Yeah, so then your elements have to be a person. And, But when you get down to the elemental level, there's no difference between what's male and what's female, is there? Yeah. So when the elements don't have gender, how can an inner self which relies on the outer self have a gender? Okay. Or to put it, you know, another way, how can the mind be male or female or neuter when it's a different entity than the body? Okay, so, so then the Vaisheshika said, well, you have the same problem, you know, in doing this. And, Aryadeva responds, well, we impute gender or sex in dependence on elements that lack inherent existence. So there's no problem from our side. So if you, you know, view a person as inherently male or female, you really get a lot of problems. Yeah, because then they have to be that same sex from one life to the next, but then not all the life forms necessarily have male or female. And it always puzzles me. You know, they say in Amitabha's Pure Land, there's no women. Yeah? But if there's no women, then there can't be any men either. Yeah, because you can't posit. I mean, you only have men because there's women because they use their sexuality to reproduce. So if there's no women to have children, then there don't need to be men to help to be the other half of having children. But when I ask that question, I've never gotten a satisfactory answer.
Did you ever ask a female?
Huh?
Did you ever ask a female? There isn't any, obviously. You could only ask the men.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, you can only have one if you have the other. Otherwise, you know, it's why have you can't, you know, it makes no sense.
But maybe it's not really male.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. It can't be really male.
Yeah.
So. So then saying there's no women in the Pure Land, what does that mean? And it means there's no men either. So then there's something else, isn't there? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Then verse 228 is, yourself is not myself. Thus there is no such self. Since it is not ascertained, does the conception not arise in relation to impermanent things? Okay, so there's an unwanted conclusion that generating the thought I when observing somebody else's self is unreasonable. I mean, I wouldn't generate the thought I observing yourself, okay? So that which is yourself isn't myself. So the object of your conception of I isn't a self existing from its own side. Okay? Because that's not the object of my conception of I or my attachment to I. Okay? So here, if this other school is asserting there's a self that exists from but with its own entity, yeah, then everybody who looked at that self should say I. Because if something exists by its own entity, that's what it is, and everybody would have to see it the same way. So that would mean that when I looked at your aggregates, I would generate the thought I. And then I could look at everybody's aggregates and generate the thought I. And in fact, all of us would look at each other's aggregates and generate the thought I. And that's clearly nonsense, isn't it? But if there were a self that existed with its own entity, then things would have to be like that. Because something that has its own entity is that. It doesn't depend on being labeled that. It doesn't exist in relationship to anything else. Remember before we were talking that I only exists in relationship to there being you? Otherwise, how can you differentiate you and I? You know, in the same way that this and that depend on each other. All these things are mutually dependent. If they had their own entity, they wouldn't have to depend on anything else. Yeah, and then everybody would see them exactly the same way. Okay. So these people are saying, okay, there's some permanent self there that exists with its own entity. And in that case, you know, everybody would look at it and say I equally, which of course is nonsense. So then doesn't the thought I arise in relationship to impermanent things? Yeah, the thought I doesn't arise in relationship to a permanent self or a permanent soul. It arises in relationship to impermanent things. Impermanent meaning changing moment by moment. So we think of I, or we think of the person, we think of the self in relationship to the five aggregates. You know, one aggregate is our body, and then four aggregates are our mind, feeling, discriminations, volitional factors and consciousness. And so it's only in relationship to these five aggregates, which all of which are in constant change, that we can identify a person. So there's no permanent self there that you can look at and say, oh, that is inherently I. It's a nice thought, isn't it? It kind of makes you secure, like, okay, even when I die, then there's still this thing that's me that isn't going to change. So it's kind of, you know, for our mind that doesn't want to feel insecure, oh yeah, there's a permanent me there. But then if you start asking, is it possible for a permanent me to exist, then you get all these different problems. You know, like everybody would see me, you know, looking at the same self. And that self wouldn't change from life to life. We're going to get into that. Yeah. And that self would be inherently a man or inherently a woman or inherently neuter. Yeah. And none of that stuff makes sense. Then 229 is refuting that a permanent self is the cause of entering and leaving samsara. So, you know, these people say, well, the self is permanent, and it's the one that enters samsara, that takes rebirth, and that leaves samsara, and that gets liberated. If there were no self, who is in samsara due to karma? And if there's no self, then who would gain freedom from samsara? Thus, a self has to exist. And in their mind, if a self exists, it has to be a permanent self that exists with its own identity, its own inherent identity. And so verse 229 says, from one rebirth to another, the person changes like the body. It is illogical for yours to be separate from the body and permanent. Okay? So if there's some kind of permanent self, yeah, that's a separate entity from the body, yeah, then the body changes from one life to the next. So, you know, wouldn't the person have to change from one life to the next? Or because the person, like the it is illogical for the self to be permanent and a separate entity from the body, because the person, like the body, changes from one rebirth to the next. Okay? So if the self were permanent, yeah, well, first of all, it's saying it can't be permanent because the self changes. Because one lifetime, the self is human, the next it's God, the next it's in this realm, the next it's in that realm. Okay, so the experience is that it's a different self because there's a different body. Yeah, we don't have the same body from one lifetime to the next. So how could we have the same self from one lifetime to the next? Is this making some sense to you? Okay. And if, you know, they're saying, okay, there has to be a real self that enters into samsara and that leaves samsara, and that's a permanent, unchanging self. But if the self were permanent, how could it enter into samsara? How entering samsara means taking rebirth. If the self didn't have any change and it were separate from the body and the other aggregates, then how could it take rebirth? Because taking rebirth involves change. Yeah? Doesn't it? So how can you say it's exactly the same self, but it also was born in a different body and has different mental aggregates and different thoughts and different feelings? Yeah, that doesn't make any sense, does it? And if the self were permanent and didn't change from moment to moment, then also how could it attain nirvana? Yeah, a permanent self doesn't change. It can't change. It's not impacted by other things. So then it can't be liberated. Yeah? So permanent self can't take rebirth. It can't be liberated. It actually can't do anything. It can't see anything. Yeah? We're going to get into all of these things, you know, how we keep thinking, but there's a permanent self. Yeah? Or there's a truly existent self, some self that's there without depending on other things. But, you know, we keep coming back to, if it has its own entity, if it's independent of everything else, then it would have to be permanent. And if it's permanent, it can't take rebirth, it can't be freed from samsara. Yeah, it would be inherently male or inherently female, no matter what body it was born into. Yeah, it couldn't see anything because it would be entirely unrelated and separate to the mind that cognizes things. Okay, and then we move into the Vaisheshikas, who say that there's a permanent self that is an activator of the body. Okay, so there's a permanent self that is an intangible form that moves the body. Now that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah, an intangible form that's permanent that moves the body. Doesn't that sound great? That's who you are. And we have that image, don't we? You know, it's like, oh, there's some form, some intangible form. Like when when Hollywood talks about rebirth, there's some form that comes up and, you know, out of this body and goes into another body. There was some movie some years ago where the father of a family or somebody in the family was reborn as the dog that came to live in the family. You know, so they showed that happening as, you know, there was this intangible form that left the father or whoever it was that when he got in an accident and then went into the puppy. Yeah. Okay. So we have this idea. There's an intangible form and it's permanent. It's still the father. You know, it's still the father. It's the father who's now born in the puppy's body. Yeah, same personality, trying to communicate to the rest of the family that, hey, I'm your father, but it's a puppy.
Is this a comedy?
It was, yes. Yes, it was a comedy. I can't remember the name of it, but, you know, it was such a good example of, you know, how we think of things. Okay. So that's the Vaisheshikas say, you know, there's a permanent self that's an intangible form, and it's what makes the body move. Okay? And the response is a permanent self can't move anything. Okay? Because to make something move, it has to change. Yeah. And the Vaisheshikas are seeing this permanent intangible self. You know, they say it's like an activator of the body, like a chariot has to have a driver. So there's this self that moves the body. And the response is, you know, that can't be a permanent thing, can't make anything else move. Okay.
Now I see why the Buddha won all those debates.
Yeah. Yeah. And then 231 invalidates the belief in a permanent self. It says, this is an excellent verse. Why teach nonviolence and wonder about conditions for permanent self? A diamond never has to be protected against woodworm. Okay? So if the self were permanent, then why do you need to teach nonviolence as a mode of conduct in order to protect the self from the dangers of a bad rebirth? Because a permanent self can't change. So it can't be reborn. Even if it were reborn in the hell realms, it wouldn't experience any pain because it's permanent, and a permanent thing can't change. It can't be influenced by other causes and conditions. Okay? So nothing can harm a permanent self. So why, you know, teach somebody to, you know, to avoid harmful actions and create good actions? Because that permanent self can't experience the results of it because it can't change. Okay? This is actually a very good argument, you know. If you hold the idea, like in Christianity or theistic religions, that there's a permanent soul, then again, you know, why keep good ethical conduct? You're supposed to keep good ethical conduct so you can be born in heaven and not born in hell. But if there's a permanent soul, it can't be reborn. And even if it were born in heaven or in hell, it couldn't experience anything, because to experience something, you need to change and you need to be influenced by other conditions. Yeah? But, you know, here we are. We assert things that can't possibly exist. Yeah? Okay, so a diamond doesn't need to be protected from woodworm because it can't be adversely affected by it. So a permanent a self can't be adversely affected by lower rebirths, so then there's no reason for it to keep good ethical conduct. Who in the world would say that? Yeah, that's really nihilistic, isn't it? Okay. And then verse 233, refuting proof of a permanent self, seeing that memory of past lives is unsuitable as proof of a permanent self. So here's somebody saying, but there's got to be a permanent self because we can remember things. So Aryadeva says, if your self is permanent because of remembering other lives, how can your body be impermanent when you see a scar previously formed? Okay, so what's happening here is somebody saying the self is permanent because there's memory of previous lives. And memory of previous lives isn't possible for something that disintegrates as soon as it arises. So something that is impermanent disintegrates as soon as it arises. And these people are thinking, since it disintegrates, since it arises, it completely goes out of existence. So then the self that arises the next moment is a completely different self. It's not existing in the continuity. It's not that one, you know, the self is arising and ceasing at the same time. So there's a continuity of moments that arise in dependence on the previous moment, and as it ceases, produce the next moment. They're thinking that if something, you know, arises and disintegrates in the next moment, then it's totally non-existent. There's no continuity. So then the person that arises in the next moment couldn't remember what happened to the person in the previous moment. Okay? In the same way that if you have this permanent self, then the self of the next life couldn't remember what happened to it in a previous life. Okay? So then Aryadeva says, if you think I was a human last life, how could your body be impermanent and have changed? So if you think I was a human, then you're saying I and the human body are the same thing. Yeah, I was a human. The I is permanent, so the human body must be permanent. Okay? So then how could your body be impermanent and have been changed if you say that there's a permanent self? And if you say I was a human being? Yeah, making some sense? Okay. So it should be permanent because in a past life you had a scar somewhere, and now when you see a birthmark that resembles that scar, you think this is the scar from when I was injured in the past life. So we're talking about two nonsensical conceptions that people have, you know, that if you have a birthmark in some part of your body, then that indicates in a previous life you were injured there. You know, no, it doesn't. Yeah. But if your body were, you know, this person is still thinking that they're permanent, you know, because they find a birthmark where they got injured in a previous life. But then if the self were the body, your body's completely changed, so it can't be permanent. Okay? Yeah? Kind of like saying, okay, in life one, I get injured, so I have, you know, I have my scar here, right? From when I fell down when I was a baby. So then next life, yeah, or maybe I look at the scar, the scar was caused this life. So the next life, let's say I have some birthmark here. And then I think, oh, you know, there's a permanent self that came from the previous life because I have a birthmark in this place where in the previous life I have a scar because I fell down and cut my lip on my face on an ashtray when I was a baby. Yeah? So there's a permanent self, so then, you know, the scar indicates that. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't make any sense because your body is totally different. Yes, we'd be covered with birthmarks from all of our previous lives, wouldn't we? Okay. Okay. So the way the Prasangika Bandhyamakas thing is that the thought I is coextensive with both the self of the past and the self of this life and the self of the future. Okay, so the self that is the object of the conception I is a generality. Okay, it's not something that has a fixed identity that exists with its own nature. It's just a generality that includes all the different selves from all the different lives and all the different moments we exist. And none of those selves exist with their own entity either, because if they did, then you would have multiple selves, and it would all be really nutty. Okay? So even though we say the self of this life is not the self of next life, because the self of this life is imputed in dependence upon the aggregates of this life, and the self of next life is imputed in dependence on those aggregates, and the self of our previous life is imputed in dependence on the body and mind from that lifetime. So it's three selves. They're not the same self because they're imputed on different aggregates, but they're not inherently different either, because there's a continuity from one self to the next self. Yeah. And all of those selves are included in the generality when we just say I, for example. So, for example, when the Buddha would say, in my past life, I did this and that, he wasn't meaning Shakyamuni Buddha in the past life was an elephant, you know? That the self that is now Shakyamuni, you know, Shakyamuni was the elephant in the previous life. It was rather the previous continuity of the self that is Shakyamuni in this life was an elephant in a previous life. You know, because in the Jataka tales, they tell the story of the Buddha when he was a bodhisattva, and he was often born as animals, you know, that acted for the benefit of you know, living beings in different ways. Okay? So when he would say, you know, I was so-and-so in a previous life, it doesn't mean the self of this life is the self of that past life. The I that he's saying is referring to the generality I, the general I. Yeah. But that I can't be found anywhere, because it's merely labeled in dependence upon all the instances of I in all the different lives. In the same way that the I of this life is merely imputed to the I of the infant, the I of the toddler, the I of the child, the I of the teenager, the I of the young adult, the I of, you know, we have many different I's even during this lifetime, because the basis upon which the I is labeled, the body and mind, changes. Yeah, but when we say, I did this and that, we're just referring to the generality I of this lifetime. We're not referring to necessarily, you know, the I when I was a toddler or at any particular stage. Okay, so you can use language like this, and it makes sense because things don't inherently exist. If the self or anything else had its own permanent essence in it, or had something that made it, that made it that without depending on anything else, then things could not be merely labeled. Yeah, they would have fixed entities. And then you know, using language would be very, very difficult. You couldn't say, I remember this and that. Because then you'd have to say the I at this moment is the exact same I that lived 5 years ago, in which case you wouldn't have changed at all in the last 5 years.
You couldn't have memory,
right? Because you'd be exactly the same as 5 years ago. Okay? So you see that, you know, language and convention, you know, how we talk about things in a conventional self, that in a conventional way, that only works because things don't have their own inherent identity. You know, if they had an inherent identity, nothing could function. Yeah? Okay? So then they use this example. And I'm going to tell you this example because it comes up a lot in different texts. And it's it took me years to understand this example. Okay, so there's a bowl of yogurt in a house. Okay, the footprint of a pigeon on the roof can be seen in the bowl of yogurt in the house, even though the foot of the pigeon didn't touch the yogurt. So that is the analogy. Okay. There's another one about the bear. What is it? The bear who wakes up from his hibernation and feels sick and then remembers that he got bitten by a rodent before, or you know, he feels something unusual and then that causes the memory. Okay, so what this means, it's a funny example for our culture. What I think it means anyway is that, you know, in the old houses in ancient India, you could have a bowl of yogurt on the table, and then you have the roof over it. The roof is made of thatch. So if a pigeon lands on the roof, it's going to move things, and so dirt is going to fall down from the roof and land in the bowl of yogurt and make the imprint of the pigeon's footprint in the yogurt. And so that can happen even though the pigeon didn't even touch the yogurt. Okay? So the way I'm understanding that is that the roof is this life. Yeah. The yogurt is another life, your next life. And the footprint is the karma.
Oh, nice.
So the karma is formed in this lifetime, but it ripens in a future lifetime, even though the action did not touch the future lifetime, and even though the roof does not touch the yogurt. Okay? So similarly, all actions and agents are feasible for that which arises dependently. So that's how I understand the example. Okay? So it's showing that an action can be created in one life and the result experienced in another life without any permanent thing going from one lifetime to the next. Yeah? Okay.
The other way I was looking at it is that what about if the pigeon were sitting on the roof and the roof had some hole in it? And there was a sun casting a shadow behind the pigeon so that when it hit and the pigeon was maybe scratching its head, like we put our hand out and the sun cast a shadow on the foot.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So maybe the pigeon's foot, the sun cast a shadow onto the yogurt due to the positioning of the pigeon's foot and the sun.
Yeah.
Kind of the same thing. Where
yeah.
The sun would be the...
Yeah.
The karma, the pigeon would be whatever
yeah.
you said. That
would be yeah, no, the foot would still be the karma. It's the
right.
idea that you create something in one life and you
and
experience
touched,
the result
yeah.
later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, both examples work. Okay. Verse 233 is the unfeasibility of mindless matter remembering past rebirths.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this again is based on the Vaisheshikas, and I can't say I really understand their philosophy. So anyway, the verse says, if the self, when possessing that which has mind, is a knower, by that same argument, that which has mind would be mindless and the person permanent. Okay, so the Vaisheshikas have some kind of assertion that between a substance and its attributes, you know, and so, you know, they say there's a self and then an attribute of the self is the intelligent. And, you know, you have different consciousnesses and intelligence that are all attributes of the self. I can't say I really understand this. Okay. But if so Joe Blow says, then the self should not be able to remember past rebirths because it is mindless matter. That's true. It also couldn't remember past lives by virtue of having mind, because by first lacking memory and later possessing memory, it has given up its entity. Okay? So if the self, which is matter, is a knower of the past, you know, it has to do with a complicated Vaisheshika philosophy, yeah, which I can't say I understand. But they were the ones that said before that there was this self that was permanent, that was the intangible form, and yet somehow it's related to consciousness. I think we're going to skip this verse. Okay? The next verse, I don't think, is much easier. Okay, because again, it's talking about the Vaisheshika's belief of that which has attributes such as intelligence remembers past rebirths. So it has something to do with the self being permanent, but yeah, this is it. The self is permanent, but it has attributes like consciousness that are impermanent. Okay, so, but then if, you know, you have a permanent self that then can see things because it possesses a consciousness that is impermanent, then that permanent self should have to be impermanent. It should be able to change from being permanent into being impermanent. Okay? Because if you have this permanent self that doesn't change, but that permanent self possesses some kind of intelligence or consciousness or something that perceived things that was impermanent. And because the consciousness perceived things, then this permanent self could perceive things. That permanent self couldn't be permanent, would have to be impermanent. Okay? Yeah. In the same way, like if you have this permanent self and it has attributes like, you know, a painful feeling or a pleasurable feeling, then if you're going to say that the self feels pain or pleasure because it possesses this permanent self, you know, experiences pain and pleasure because it possesses, you know, the feelings of pain and pleasure, then again, that self's going to have to change in order to experience those feelings. Whereas they have some philosophy whereby, you know, you have the thing that experiences feelings that's impermanent, but that's what makes the permanent self experience something. But that doesn't hang together, because something can't first be permanent and then become impermanent, and something can't first be impermanent and then become permanent. Because the very nature is, you know, one changes with causes and conditions and disintegrates momentarily, and the other is not affected by causes and conditions and doesn't disintegrate. So they have two completely different natures. So something that's one can't become the other.
When you talk about impermanent, like, it sounds like it's inert.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something that's permanent can't move.
It's inert.
It's inert. Because to move, like before when they were saying that you have this permanent self that moves the body, for something to move means it's changed. Yeah. Or for something to cause something else to move, it has to change.
So you can think, you can do nothing.
It can't do anything if it's permanent. That's a good question. You know, I think because there's something very appealing about the idea of a permanent self, because for them, if you say that there isn't a permanent self, then they can't say how karma goes from one lifetime to the next and how there's a continuity. So they say there has to be a permanent self that goes from one lifetime to the next. Otherwise, if you don't have that, then everything ends at the time of death. But we say, if you have a permanent self, then it's impossible for that self to go on to the next life. Yeah? And then for sure, at the time of death, there would be no continuity, because permanent things don't have any continuity.
Do permanent things die?
No.
Then how could it die?
Yeah, it couldn't die. Yeah. Right.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I remember when Krishna Dorje Dhamdo was here, I remember him saying that, I thought it was many people of these views, one thing that was very comforting was you could have all this pleasure of being, especially being in your life, but you had this soul that was this permanent self that was untouched by it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very consoling to the person, because they could have a body that was riddled with disease and all the problems in their life. This was the example he gave. But hey, the person could, don't worry about those things.
Yeah.
You have this other thing that's
okay. That's permanent. Untouched. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then your experience is exactly the opposite. Yeah, because you're experiencing pain. So then, are you going to say that permanent self doesn't experience pain?
Which means it's not you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's hurt. How come?
Yeah. Because it exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon the body and mind, which are both impermanent. Okay. Next verse. So now we're going to get into refuting the self imputed by the Samkhyas. So they assert a permanent conscious person. Okay. So if consciousness is permanent, an agent is superfluous. If fire is permanent, fuel is unnecessary. Okay. So if consciousness is permanent, then you wouldn't need a self to apprehend anything. You wouldn't need sense organs to apprehend anything, because consciousness being permanent either would always apprehend the same thing or it would never apprehend anything. Yeah? I mean, this is the problem whenever you say that something exists by its own entity. It means that either it's always that way or it can't ever be that way. Okay? So the Samkhyas say, if the self were matter like you Vaisheshikas think, then these inconsistencies apply. But we say the person's nature is to be conscious, so there's not this problem. You can have a conscious permanent self. Okay? So the Samkhyas speak of 25 categories of phenomena. 24 of them are matter. 25th is the knower or the person or the self. And they say that the person experiences objects that the intellect makes it crave, but the intellect is one of those permanent things. Okay, so if the conscious person were permanent, okay, the eyes and so forth that permit experience of objects wouldn't be needed, because the person that experiences objects would be a permanent functional phenomena. Remember that? Yeah. But you can't have something that's permanent that is also a functional phenomena, because something that functions, function means it produces a result. Okay. So fuel is needed to make a fire, but if fire is permanent, you don't need fuel, because fire would always be there and it could burn on itself without fuel. Okay, so similarly, if the person were permanent, you wouldn't need consciousness, you wouldn't need sense organs, you wouldn't need an object, you wouldn't need anything, because that permanent person would always be experiencing that thing. But that's certainly not the case, is it? Yeah. We don't experience one thing forever and ever and ever. Yeah? What we call I changes. And it's a good thing it does, too, doesn't it? Okay? So, any questions? Yeah?
How do you the higher school group, maybe
how do they explain memory? Oh, they have this big thing, you know, in the context of refuting inherent existence that explains memory. Oh, I know what it is. I remember now. It comes in the context of refuting a wrong-rig, the self-knower, remember, apperception? Remember, because the Satantrikas and some of the other lower schools say that a consciousness has another consciousness that is one nature with it that perceives it. And so they say that's how you can remember things, because the apperception remembers the consciousness that, and the apperception enables the memory of the consciousness that apprehended the object. And the Prasangikas say, you don't need to assert an apperception that remembers the consciousness that apprehended the object, because as soon as you remember the object, you also remember apprehending it. Yeah, because you can't remember an object without knowing that you apprehended it sometime in the past. Okay?
What means apprehend?
Apprehend means to cognize or to know.
Okay. What about with memories of past lives?
Pardon me?
How does that apply with memory of past lives?
Memory of past lives? I think they would say because there are seeds, you know, planted in the consciousness. Or again, the Prasangikas have this thing called the having happened of something. Yeah. So you know, kind of that continuity of a consciousness that apprehended something in the past, yeah, then that consciousness has a continuity. So it can remember, you know, there's like some seed, or there would have to be some kind of having happened, you know, that enables you to remember something from the past.
It seems like it would be, you know, different whether it was this life or a previous.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's easier to assert, it's easier to accept this life, mm-hmm. Yeah, because we think of it as being the same person, even though it's not in this lifetime. Yeah. So the difficulty, you know, the scientists would say the memory is in part of your brain. But if that were so, then you could never account for memories of previous lives, because you don't have the same brain from one lifetime to the next. Yeah. And I have trouble saying the memory. Could you say the memory is the brain? Because then you would have to say a memory is electrical impulses, or the memory is chemicals. Or then if you say the memory stored in the brain, then how does the brain, you know, make conscious experience?
That's yeah. Material.
Yeah.
You know, something material, making something immaterial.
Yeah. And so I think if you get into Tantra, my guess is in Tantra you would say that the winds make that connection between the mind and the body. Yeah. I think you would have to say that's what makes the connection.
But is the brain just like the liver and the chakra?
It's just some it's just something made of matter, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, it's made of matter. And when you look, if you had a brain in a Petri dish and you looked at two nerve synapses, you know, doing something, you wouldn't look at it and say, that's anger. Yeah. You couldn't say those nerves and the cells were anger. Yeah. You know? In the same way that you wouldn't look at somebody's brain and say, I love you. You know, the brain is not the person. Yeah, it's not the person. Any other questions?
Well, the diseases that, you know, attack a brain and then result in dementia.
Yeah. So, yeah, so there's some way that the mind and the brain influence each other. Yeah. But you don't know. You know, is it because things in the brain, they don't really know with dementia or Alzheimer's, because there's a correlation between this plaque and the disease. But a correlation doesn't necessarily mean one thing causes the other. It just means that they're both there at the same time.
And that's true, because you can do PET scans or whatever they do now on some brains, and they have the plaque, and the person is perfectly alert and has good memory and
yeah.
Functions quite well. And yet the brain looks like a diseased brain.
Brain, yeah.
But maybe it will come later?
Yeah, it could mean that, but it's hard to say.
Regeneration of brain. I mean, that whole phenomenon of the regeneration of brain.
Brain cells, yeah.
They don't get at all.
Yeah.
The elasticity. Yeah. And then injuries to the brain, you can never predict what the outcome is going to be. You cannot.
Yeah. From a brain injury, you can't predict the outcome. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think a lot. You know, I was gonna email Deborah Hicks over there at you want to see how Charlie's doing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's for me, that's a perfect example. Here's a head injury, but there's someone who has a mind that's very strong and has deep practice and had courage. I mean, there's something about the personal temperament of somebody that may influence what happens with a head injury.
Yeah,
how
yeah.
they deal with it and how they work with it and what their capacities on a different level than just, you know, what happened in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine's mother had Alzheimer's, and she was, you know, she'd go to visit her, and she'd be like, "Oh, it's that young girl again visiting," and, you know, she wouldn't understand who it was. And then one day she was just totally cleared for a few hours.
It's true. You find that with Alzheimer's, that, you know, or with any kind of dementia, somebody can be like completely out of it one time and then clear, you know, a few hours later. Yeah.
So it seems like that, even if it is the brain that's damaged, it's damaging access maybe to something that's still there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Right.
Well, maybe it's just these karmic obscurations. I mean, medical science has to come up with something. So they'll say it's that.
Yeah. I mean, we really don't know, do we? Yeah? Because things can change from one moment to the next. And, you know, there's so many different causes and conditions going into something. Okay. So shall we dedicate this impermanent, you know, having disintegrated or the impermanent karmic seeds on the mind stream that is changing from moment to moment, and the I that is also changing because it's merely labeled and unfindable.